KALW.
It's called everybody should have the right to vote that live here. It ain't just parolees.
It's just a week away. California will decide on a measure that could allow people on parole to vote.
I think it's a really bad message.
We'll learn more about Prop 17 and hear who's for it and who's not. Then, when Californians move to Texas and change the local political scene.
There's something about the way they walk or something. I usually say, are you from California? And 99% of the time, I'm right, okay?
Plus, we get spooky with one filmmaker who takes us on a haunted tour of the Bay Area.
Sure, we've had scary things happen, but we try to keep it as, you know, like as real as possible.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. California is one of just three states that requires people convicted of felonies to finish parole before they can vote. Prop 17 would change that and grant voting rights to nearly 40,000 Californians on parole. KALW Justice reporter Holly J. McDeed joins me now to explain. Hey, Holly.
Hi, Hannah.
So, Holly, people on parole, they're under a state of supervision after serving a prison sentence for a felony, and they live under certain conditions, right?
Exactly. So in California, like many states, people on parole, they can't possess guns, they have to report to parole officers, and if they violate parole conditions, they can be sent back to prison. And right now, in California, another aspect of being on parole is not being able to vote. And so I spoke to someone named Terry Williams, who was allowed to vote for the first time last year at age 69.
For the first time, it felt good to actually go inside of a voting booth and be able to vote, something that my parents, my grandparents, and ancestors fought for so many years and weren't able to do.
And Holly, why hasn't Terry been able to vote until recently?
So since he was 13 years old, he's either been on probation, in prison, or on parole. And he's been out of prison for about 3 years now. And so the first time he voted last year, it was in local races in Stockton. And that was a huge deal for him. But in a few days, I mean, for the first time, he'll be able to vote for the next U.S. president.
This one is a lot bigger.
And he also plans to vote for Prop 17, which would have allowed him to vote while on parole. Supporters of this measure, like him, say that people who have served their time in prison should be allowed to participate in democracy when they're released. I also spoke with someone named Dorsey Nunn. He's the co-founder of All of Us or None, a movement to restore civil and human rights to millions of people who were once incarcerated, and for people who are currently incarcerated. He says he began thinking about voting rights ever since he was sentenced to prison in 1972.
That made me question things in a way that I hadn't questioned. So like when you run into, you know, an extraordinary large number of black people locked up in a cage, you try to wrap your head around, why is that?
Nunn became politically active behind bars during a time when the Black Panther Party held political education courses in the prison yard. When he got out of prison, on the way out of prison, he told people he wasn't going to forget about them. And voting for him is one way of doing that.
When I got ready to cast my first vote, I dressed up for it along with a number of other people. I said, where are you going, man? Where are you going in that suit and tie, man? I'm going to vote. When's the last time you dressed up to go vote?
And his group, All of Us or None, is one of the groups pushing for Prop 17. And he says the fight for voting rights in America is also a fight for racial justice and inclusion. The demographics of Californians on parole who can't vote are disproportionately African American and Latino.
Mm-hmm. And so, Holly, what about the opponents of Prop 17? What are they saying?
So the opponents of Prop 17 argue that people on parole haven't fully integrated back into society because parole is still a part of their sentence. And so they say they shouldn't be allowed to vote until they finish that aspect of their sentence. I spoke with former prosecutor Nina Salerno-Bezelman, who opposes Prop 17.
It's been termed by the proponents, well, you know, the rights should be restored at the end of their term. Well, that's kind of misleading because the term also includes parole.
Salarno Bezelman is also president of Crime Victims United, which was founded by her parents. She says she's never really had a choice but to advocate with her family for victims' rights. She was 12 years old when her older sister was killed by her ex-boyfriend in 1979. She says Prop 17 sends the wrong message to violent offenders.
I think it's a really bad message to say, hey, look, you can commit a pretty violent crime, because the people sitting in our state prisons now are people that have committed violent and serious offenses, yet you can come right back out of society, perhaps on an early release, not even serving your full term, and then you get this very critical right restored without even understanding the impact it could have on the community.
And Holly, where does California fit in with the rest of the country?
So if you look nationwide, 18 states and Washington, D.C., they allow people who are released from prison who've committed felonies the right to vote as soon as they're out. In two states, Maine and Vermont, inmates can vote from prison. And that's what Dorsey Nunn with All of Us or None want. He spoke at an event in the state capitol last year. The event, it's called Quest for Democracy. And hundreds of people were there, and most of them were formerly incarcerated.
Now, what I told everybody last night, if they give parolees the right to vote, I will not be stopping there. It's because everybody should have the right to vote that live here.
But just to recap, Prop 17 doesn't go that far. It would allow people on parole for felonies the right to vote. It would also give some people on parole the chance to run for office.
All right. Thank you, Holly.
Thanks, Sana.
Holly J. McDeed is KALW's justice reporter. You can find her stories at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. California's high cost of living has pushed hundreds of thousands of people to leave the state in recent years, and Texas has been a favored destination. More than 700,000 have moved there since 2008. It's part of the reason why historically bright red Texas has turned surprisingly purple in 2020, with polls showing President Trump having a narrow lead over Democratic challenger Joe Biden. From our partners at Capital Public Radio and Cal Matters, reporter Matt Levin catches up with one voter making Texas bluer.
When Dr. Maisha Taylor saw her Biden-Harris lawn sign was missing from the front yard, she did what any parent would do. She blamed her kids.
And they were like, we didn't touch it. I don't know. Nobody knows anything, right? I said, well, I'm going to rewind these cameras. Let's rewind the cameras. We could see exactly what happened to the sign.
Taylor and her husband sat their three children down to scour through the security tape. It was like family movie night, with the added intrigue that someone in the audience might be guilty.
And we're watching, and then we see the car come up and turn on our street and then stop. And we're like, wait, why are they stopping in front of our house?
It's nighttime and the camera is pretty far away, but it's clear what's happening. Somebody gets out of the passenger seat, jumps on Taylor's retaining wall, and takes the Biden-Harris sign.
You're just standing there like, I cannot believe this actually happened, right? I'm from California. Like, I never would I thought that Trump would have won. And I'm thinking, who voted for this guy? Then I moved here and I realize who voted for this guy, right?
Here for Taylor is Tarrant County, Texas, home to Fort Worth, Arlington, and an endless stretch of freshly subdivided bedroom communities. Over the past decade, those bedrooms have been filled by a steady stream of Californians lured by a booming economy and cheap homes. Taylor hasn't solved the case of the Great Lawn Sign Heist just yet. But one possible motive? Fear that Texas, home of Ted Cruz and George W. Bush and open carry gun laws, could actually vote for a Democrat this year.
Trump has fairly consistently led over the last few months, but really in the most recent polling by 5 points or less, and there have even been a few polls that have had the race even or within one or two.
Jim Henson is a professor and pollster at the University of Texas at Austin. He says the tight presidential race shouldn't surprise anyone who has been paying attention to Texas politics over the last decade. In 2018, Democrat Beto O'Rourke lost to Senator Ted Cruz by only a few percentage points. Henson says it's a mistake to say Texas is trending blue just because of California expats. But he says recent transplants are reshaping the politics of Texas suburbs. It's why you won't find a bigger fan of Californians than Deborah Peoples, chair of the Tarrant County Democratic Party. Many of her new volunteers have come from Southern California or the Bay Area.
There's something about their way they walk or something. I usually say, are you from California? And 99% of the time, I'm right, okay?
Historically, Tarrant County has been a Republican stronghold. Lyndon Johnson was the last Democratic presidential candidate to win it. But national Democrats are for the first time in decades pouring money into the county, hoping they can finally flip it for Biden and win some congressional seats along the way.
I think we're seeing this level of activism among Californians. When they get here, they look at the political landscape. They say, this doesn't look like where I came from. And what do I do to change it?
The Texas GOP is not rolling out the welcome mat. Like Trump, they're using California's problems, exorbitant home prices, homelessness, to mobilize their own voters. Don't California my Texas was a campaign slogan for the Republican governor. Dr. Myesha Taylor says some of the anti-California rhetoric has a grain of truth to it. And she loves some parts of living in Texas. It's been her home for the past 11 years. So after all that time, does she consider herself more a Texan or a Californian now?
Oh, Californian. I'm just living in Texas right now.
In Sacramento, I'm Matt Levin.
Matt is a reporter with the nonprofit news site Cal Matters. That story was produced in partnership with Capital Public Radio. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. It's almost Halloween, and although we probably won't be going trick-or-treating this year, there's stuff we can still do, like hear some ghost stories about the Bay Area. Filmmaker Ying Lu can tell you a ton of them because she actually searches for ghosts. Lu is the director of the documentary series The Haunted Bay, which streams on Amazon Prime Video. She and her team explore haunted places around the Bay Area, from gay bars to old ships, but they also learn a lot of history, too. The series was born from a class assignment Lu did while studying at Oakland's Laney College. The Haunted Bay's third season begins in San Francisco with Lu, the Alameda Paranormal Researchers, and psychic June Ahern. KLW's Janae Darden spoke to Ying Lu about why she's drawn to spooky things.
Have you always believed in ghosts?
You know, that's an interesting question because I didn't realize that I didn't until I started doing this. I always thought I believed in ghosts, but what I really was I was into ghost stories. I was into horror movies. It was fun to believe because it's creepy and cool. And even though I had a couple of things happen before I started this series, I kind of, like, my rational mind would come in and kind of dismiss it a little bit. And so when I started this project, my idea was this is going to be just something fun and adventurous. We'll go in the dark. We'll follow these paranormal investigators. You know, and we're just going to be flies on the wall and just watch them. And then things started to happen to us. And that's when we were like, oh, my God, this is possibly actually real. Mm-hmm. And it's been a journey. It's actually been a journey. And I'm still sometimes step back and I'm like, wow, I can't believe the things that we've seen, the things that have happened since we started this project when we're just supposed to be flies on the wall.
So what are some things that have happened where you were like, especially early, I mean, you're on your third season now, where you were like, whoa.
I did not really get scared until the second time I followed the Alameda Paranormal Researchers, and that was at Preston Castle. That place itself is very scary. It's like, looks like a castle. It was a reform school for boys back in the day.
And where's that at?
That's further out. That's in Ione, California, like Gold Country.
Usually we're in the Bay Area, but this time we kind of traveled out a little bit. So it's like an abandoned former boys' reform school, straight out like a horror movie. Like the inside is dilapidated and falling apart. There are even bats in there. And I went there, and I remember being, we were all standing like a line in the hallway. I went alone, because usually I have two camera guys, but this time I went alone. And I was kind of in front of everybody, and I remember having this weird feeling like I need to like not be in front because I think something's gonna attack me. And I didn't say anything or show any fear. I actually watched myself on the footage later. I just very calmly walked behind people and didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychic in their group, not June, they had their own psychic, she suddenly was like, "Oh my God, do you see him? Please tell me you're picking that up." And she said, "There's a man at the end of the hallway, like a shadow figure or something." And she's brave, and she actually walks towards him and says, "Hi, is there something you want to say?" And then suddenly she backs up in fear, and we all kind of back up with her. And if she was shaken up, and she said whatever was there just started screaming at her and jumped towards her screaming.
I know you say you liked watching horror movies. What was your favorite horror movie that really you think inspired you to do this?
I don't think any one single movie. It was more like, I mean, my favorite horror movies are like The Conjuring, The Ring, more paranormal kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The Shining, you know. But I basically really, I think my mother got me into this. She was like goth before there were goths kind of thing. She was like a cool goth mom. And she was, she got me into all these scary movies and ghost stories. And we were really close because it was just me and her. And then that's how I got, you know, I got interested in it. And also she died unexpectedly. So that was a huge shock for me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I couldn't handle the idea that she was just gone. So I was a little bit like losing it. The shock, I mean. So I remember hanging out at the bookstore and just looking for book after book about the afterlife just to ease my pain, to believe that she's still there in some form, you know. So that's how that happened. And it was actually her death that led me to find June, the medium. This is all before I started filming.
That's interesting. That's very moving that your mother, who was gothic and into like horror and into paranormal, she introduced you to this. And through losing her and through your grief, this is what led you down this path. So I think that's like really an amazing story. One thing about this show is there's history too. So it's, you know, for people who are into paranormal, you know, movies and shows and books, you get to experience that watching this, but also you learn so much history about the Bay Area. So tell us about the season 3 opener. Give us a brief synopsis.
We were filming an investigation at the Oddfellows. It's like a secret society lodge in San Francisco that's been there for a long time. And we went to their lodge down in downtown San Francisco and filmed there. And it was after we filmed that we saw the story about this coffin, you know, found under a house. And then we found that there was a link to the Oddfellow Society. So that's how that came about. And it led to, I don't want to give too much away, but it really led us to a chapter of San Francisco history that we were not aware of. You know, we had no idea that these fraternal orders, these secret societies, had a huge role in San Francisco development, in San Francisco political life. And it goes into, you know, cemeteries and how cemeteries were all over San Francisco before, and how, you know, things were moved. And so there's, you know, unless you're really into San Francisco history, not very many people talk about that. It's not a chapter of San Francisco history that people know. And in fact, you know, some people still see headstones sometimes in Ocean Beach when the sand is washed away a little bit, because when the bodies were moved from San Francisco to Colma, they weren't always moved respectfully.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope people learn about the spirit world, learn about Bay Area history from the work that you're doing?
I feel like sometimes the spirits really want us just to know their stories, and they're not all scary. You know, there's this idea that all ghosts are evil, all ghosts are dark. Sure, we've had scary things happen, but we try to keep it as, you know, like as real as possible. We don't just want to sensationalize and say, you know, oh, they're all evil or they're all demons. Whatever happens, happens. Sometimes they're just there to talk to us.
What was that?
That was filmmaker Ying Liu speaking with KELW's Janae Darden.
Look behind you.
You can watch The Haunted Bay on AsianAmericanMovies.com and Amazon Prime Video. We'll have links at KELW.org. And before we leave you, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Dingbat Superminx from Oakland from their latest album, Full Time Muse. Today's Cross Currents team includes Carla Estevez, Ren Farrell, Lisa Morehouse, Sonia Narong, True Gwynn, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Imagine your two eyes in heaven together, looking at each other. Looking at each other, imagine your two ears in heaven together, just listening to each other. Imagine your two thumbs in heaven together, talking at each other, talking at each other. I'm thinking about me while you're talking about you, but you know what they say to that old